Mellis arrived on the last chopper. With the others on his heli team, he shuffled along silently in a fog of fatigue. A particularly bad patch of his jungle rot was oozing pus. He wiped it on the sides of his trousers where it mingled with the accumulations of many weeks. The trousers hung loosely from his waist. He'd lost 25 pounds. He was a bush marine. He and his team walked as if they owned the LZ, but they were unaware of it. Mellis felt as though he was getting sick. They arrived at the supply tent. Small groups of kids from the other platoons were lying out in the front on the wet clay drinking beer. Mellis pushed aside the heavy canvas tent flap and walked in. Fitch, Hawk, Cassidy, and Kendall were there, along with a new second lieutenant. The new lieutenant looked up at Mellis and smiled, eager to please. Mellis, tired, ragged, hair touching his collar, did not smile back.
"Lieutenant," Cassidy said, "you look like you could use a beer."
He reached underneath the table and pulled out a rusty can of Black Label.
"Sorry, it's just Black Maple, but the good stuff gets picked off in Da Nang."
He punched two triangular holes in the top and handed the beer to Mellis. Mellis took a long pull. The beer was warm, but it had the taste of good memories. He felt the stinging carbonation as it went down his throat. He chugged the entire can and sighed.
"Thanks, Gunny."
Cassidy was already opening another can for him. Fitch was looking quite dapper again. His hair was cut and parted neatly on the side, and he wore clean jungle utilities. Hawk looked clean, but it wasn't in him to look dapper. Mellis noticed that he was wearing a first lieutenant's bars.
"I'd like you to meet Paul Fracasso," Fitch said quickly.
Mellis nodded at the new lieutenant, who was still beefed up from the basic school and was wearing marine-issue glasses. Mellis saw Fitch glance at Hawk. Suddenly he knew. They were going to give his platoon to this guy. Hawk was being transferred. They didn't say anything. It was what he had wanted. He'd even planted the seed with Blakely that day on Matterhorn. Now that his seed had grown to fruition, he was heartsick. He had no idea it would make him feel what he was feeling. "Where's Scar?" Mellis asked, dropping his pack onto the floor. "Back in Quang Tree to get the company pay," Hawk said. "Oh, yeah. I almost forgot we get paid for this." Mellis took another long pull on the beer, finishing it. "Well, come on, get it over with." He knew it was unfair of him, but he resented the newcomer like hell.
"Right," Fitch said, tight-lipped. "Fracasso here will take over your platoon. You're now the company executive officer, Bravo 5. I thought you'd work out better than Goodwin."
"Great, thanks." Mellis sat down on an ammunition crate and accepted another can of beer from Cassidy. "Where are you going, Hawk?" he asked.
"Three Zulu."
"Nice," Mellis said. He took another long drink. That meant Hawk would be working for Blakely as a staff officer in battalion operations. Blakely was no fool, that was certain. "Congratulations on your promotion, too."
"I've done my fucking time in the bush."
Hawk sounded a little peeved.
"Didn't say you hadn't, Ted."
Mellis drained the beer. Cassidy handed him another one, a slight twinkle in his eye.
"Thanks, Gunny," Mellis said.
"Go on," Hawk said to Fitch.
"You'd better tell the rest before he's fucking incoherent."
"The rest?" "We've been assigned Bald Eagle Sparrowhawk," Fitch said.
"Is that like fucking Batman and Robin?"
Fitch smiled, watching Mellis take another long drink. "It's the code name for a company of Marines that stands by the airstrip. If someone gets in the shit, they drop us in to exploit the situation."
"You can't be serious," Mellis said very softly.
The look on Fitch's face said that he was. Mellis's teeth were clenched so tightly he thought he'd break them.
"My fucking men can't walk," he said. "I can't fucking walk."
He stood up and kicked his pack in frustration. The floor reeled beneath him. There was the sound of another beer being opened, and Cassidy slid the can over the table to where Mellis was standing.
Have another beer, Lieutenant. It'll take the edge off.
Mellis looked at the beer, watching the foam slowly ooze onto the tabletop. He felt so tired.
The men getting plenty of beer? He asked.
Sure,
Hawk answered. You can thank Gunny Cassidy. He bought a bunch of cases for each squad with his own money.
Mellis was touched by the gesture.
Thanks, Gunny, he said.
Cassidy grunted. Can't have the kids without beer. If you're old enough to kill a man, you ought to be old enough to drink.
Mellis slugged down the can.
How long before we get off fucking Bald Eagle?
Fitz shrugged. No telling. Until the regiment needs us someplace else or they drop us into the shit. The colonel thought it would give us a rest.
Mellis wanted to ask Fitch how sitting at the edge of an LZ waiting for some fat ass to push a magic button and dump the company in the middle of a shit sandwich would be considered a rest. But he decided not to bother. What he wanted, more than anything else, was a shower.
Any clean clothes here?
He asked. Cassidy pointed to a number of open boxes stacked against the tent walls. The tent wobbled uncertainly around Mellis as he walked toward the clothing.
Floor a little slippery, Lieutenant?
Cassidy asked slyly.
You got me fucking drunk, didn't you?
Mellis said. It took him a moment to locate Cassidy.
I'll be fucked.
He took off his old clothes, not bothering to remove his boots. He looked a moment at his green underpants and threw them into the garbage along with the beer cans. For a moment he stood naked in front of everyone, with just his dog tags hanging on his sallow skin. He was struck by how vulnerable his body was. Cassidy tossed him a new set of jungle utilities. They felt stiff, heavy, and the camouflage looked oddly bright compared with the set on the floor at his feet. He pulled on the trousers without bothering with underwear. He marveled at how thin his waist had gotten, how his ribs showed.
Oh, and Mellis, said Fitch. We need a man from 1st Platoon to stand KP next 2 weeks.
Thank God, Mellis said.
You can have short round before you get someone killed.
He turned to Fracasso.
Come on, Fricassee, or whatever your fucking wop name is, I'll introduce you to your platoon.
Simpson's hands were still shaking as he poured another glass of bourbon and told Blakely what had happened. Blakely laughed derisively. Of course he told you it was off the record. He's not going to risk that star. Not now. Him and his fucking lost platoon from World War II. Look at the numbers, Colonel. We've got the highest men in the field to men in the rear ratio in the division. We're top in the battalion on man days per month actively involved in combat operations. Our congressional inquiry rate is right next to zero. Our kill ratio's been climbing ever since I've come aboard. And don't think the right people at Division and 3rd Amphibious Force don't know it.
Blakely laughed again.
If he wrote up a bad fitness report on you, we'd take the stats and blow him right into retirement.
Simpson smiled tightly.
I guess I shouldn't be such a worrywart. You worry about the numbers. That's what the people who matter worry about. Mulvaney's an anachronism. Apples and oranges. Shit.
They both started laughing.
Mellis, wearing new jungle utilities, the creases still showing, led Fracasso to a flat stretch of mud that surrounded a single tent designed to sleep 10 people. There were 2 other tents of the same size, each taken by the other 2 platoons. That left more than 100 unfortunates with less rank and seniority out in the rain. Some had rigged hooches as if they were still in the bush. Others simply threw down their packs, flak jackets and weapons, claimed a small patch of wet clay for their own, and started drinking. Mellis knew that most of them would be too drunk or stoned to rig hooches and would sleep in the rain. At least drunk or stoned, they'd get a full night of sleep. Mellis walked over to Hamilton, Skosh, Fredrickson, and Bass. He introduced Fracasso and told them that he himself was moving up to XO to replace Hawk. Bass took it with the aplomb of the professional, another boot lieutenant to train. Mellis knew the squad leaders would take it less well. They didn't appreciate the Marine Corps' need to ensure that the higher ranks were filled with combat-trained officers. Once they had broken one in, they'd rather keep him. Mellis shouted, "Squad leaders up!" And the kids, some lying on their backs and already well on their way,
relayed the call happily toward the gray sky. Jankiewicz was the first to arrive.
"I hear you're leaving us, Lieutenant," he said.
"Yeah."
"Well,"
Jankiewicz hesitated,
"congratulations on the promotion."
"It's no promotion, Jank. I'm still drawing the same pay. I suppose I'll get a few more coffee breaks when we're humping, but I'll still be humping with you guys."
"That'd be decent, sir."
Mellis felt like a turd. But this was his chance to move up. To be the executive officer this early in his tour gave him ample time to get a company. Connolly came up to them, slightly bleary-eyed, a can of beer in his hand.
"What's the new lieutenant like?"
he almost demanded. Mellis thought a moment. He could screw the guy right here by saying the wrong thing. He'd noticed the Naval Academy ring on Fracasso's finger, a lifer if he ever saw one. Jacobs arrived just behind Connolly with a silly grin on his face. Mellis just hoped Jacobs had enough sense not to smoke or he'd be caught. It would mean brig time and an automatic dishonorable discharge.
"Feeling pretty good, Jake?"
Mellis asked, suppressing the little smile that crept around the corners of his mouth. Jacobs immediately came down a little.
"Pretty good, sir."
Mellis smiled at Jacobs's serious expression.
"Now that I've got the power, if any of you jokers lose someone to the brig because they get caught smoking dope, I'll fuck your R&R quota and send you to Okinawa with all the lifers."
The group laughed.
"What's the new lieutenant like?"
Connolly asked again. Mellis scuffed the mud with his boot.
"I think you guys have drawn a lifer, but I think he's going to be a good one." "A fucking lifer, huh?"
Connolly said. They all turned to look at the new lieutenant, who was talking eagerly with Bass. Bass and Fracasso saw them and walked over. Mellis knew that the next 5 seconds were among the most important Fracasso would ever live. They could certainly mean his career, and maybe even his life. In the next 5 seconds, these three teenagers would decide if they'd work with him or not. Fracasso was clearly nervous. The three squad leaders stared at him without any sign of welcome. Mellis cleared his throat.
"Well, I guess I ought to make a flowery farewell speech, but I'll be humping along with Bass in the rear of this sorry bunch of assholes every third day, so I guess maybe I won't."
Mellis was surprised at his lack of articulation.
I'll miss you guys."
He couldn't look at them.
"This is Lieutenant Fracasso. He'll be taking over."
Mellis pointed to each of the squad leaders and made introductions.
"Sorry to see you here, sir,"
Connolly said. "I'm already in the double digits before I get my ass out of here. I'm so short I need to stand on a helmet to take a piss." Fracasso seemed momentarily taken aback, but he put his hand out to shake Connolly's.
"You're sorry? Jesus, I've got over a year."
Connolly, followed by Jankiewicz and Jacobs, shook hands. Fracasso had passed the test. It felt good to Mellis. He'd expected to be jealous. The platoon would be okay. He hadn't realized how he'd come to like these guys.
"One last thing before I go on, Fracasso's stuck with you for good. Every man gets a fucking shower. There's a water point down by the river. You squad leaders make sure everyone gets there before you're all too fucked up and drown yourselves."
2 hours later, Mellis was sitting in the mud, another warm beer in his hand. His body felt strangely light since he'd showered. It was his first shower since coming to Vietnam. The slight drizzle that was falling felt cool and refreshing on his face. He seemed to feel each individual drop of water. It was dark, but all around him he saw vague shadows getting up from small circles of friends to walk away and take a piss. Then a figure would return, stumbling across one circle or another, finding its own, and sink down again into the small mass of dark shadows. Mellis thought it must have been like this with Genghis Khan and Alexander. Mellis could have joined the other officers and staff members in the supply tent, but felt a desire to linger with the platoon. He felt a new camaraderie with these kids. He knew it was sentimental, even mawkish, and he tried not to succumb to the loss he felt at moving a step up in the hierarchy. His head ached badly, and he continually had to walk off into the bush to crap. Still, he was exceedingly happy. It was safe here. He hoped he wasn't coming down with dysentery. His new jungle utilities were already damp and muddy in the seat and knees and also slightly fouled from one of his trips into the bushes. He didn't care. If they launched the Bald Eagle the next day, he could be dead. He kept pouring down beer. With everyone getting shit-faced, China figured it was a good time to deliver the goods to Henry to be shipped back to Oakland or Los Angeles. The heavy sea bag on his shoulder was awkward and its contents jabbed against his back and side. He was sweating heavily within 2 minutes of leaving the little airfield where Bravo Company was bivouacked. When he pushed in past the heavy canvas flaps that formed the door to Henry's four-man tent, he smelled mothballs still lingering in the material. He let the sea bag down a little more quickly than he would have liked, and there was a metallic clunk as it hit the plywood floor. Henry was lying on his rack looking at a fuck book. He saw China and, after hesitating for just a moment, broke into a grin and got up and went through the hand dance. Two of Henry's friends were also there, and they did the same. It was good to be back with the brothers. Henry found a warm beer and punched two holes in it with an opener. He raised it in a mock toast and upended it, chugging the contents in about 5 seconds. Then he sat down on his rack, reached under the rubber lady, and pulled out a small pouch of marijuana with some cigarettes already rolled. He lit one, took a long toke, and handed it to China.
"I don't do that shit," China said.
He wasn't altogether sure it had been a friendly gesture. He'd talked with Henry before about black people enslaving themselves to drugs. Henry knew he didn't do that shit.
"Ah, shit, man. When you gonna get with the program, huh? This shit be just good fun. It don't hurt nobody."
"Yeah, okay. You go ahead, then." Henry passed the joint to one of his hooch mates and pulled up another can of beer, opened it, and handed it to China. China put his hands on his hips, looking down. Then he looked up at Henry.
"You know I don't do that shit either."
Henry raised his eyebrows and looked over at the others. He held the can out from him, pulling his head back, and pretended to study it carefully.
"What I got here, China? Devil in a can?"
China hesitated a moment. He really wanted that beer. But he knew that the Muslim brothers didn't drink. Then again, they weren't getting their asses shot off in a hot fucking jungle. He also knew that he'd have to stand up to his stated ideals.
"Hey, Henry, you got a soda or something?"
he asked, trying to be casual. Henry chugged the second can of beer, then walked over to the end of his bunk and pulled out a whole case of Coca-Cola. He levered open a can and handed it to China, grinning.
"I got everything, brother."
China took it and sat down on the rack facing Henry, the heavy sea bag on the floor between his feet. He drank the warm Coke. It tasted like summer back home. The joint got smoked down to where it was too hot to handle, and one of Henry's friends put it in a silver roach clip. Henry had the last full pull before there was nothing left. There was small talk, catching up, what brother made at home, what brother didn't. Then Henry fixed on China's eyes, a signal.
"Parker really try and frag that racist bastard?"
China hesitated.
"I think so."
Henry snorted.
"Too bad he fucked up."
There were nods and murmurs of agreement. China wasn't seeing the scene in the tent. He was seeing Parker being carried out of the perimeter in the dark, face bathed in sweat, fear in his eyes. He had tapped knuckles and given Parker a reassuring hand grip. That was the last he would ever see of Parker. He came back to the present.
"I think the gunny must have spotted something. He says it's all bullshit."
"Bullshit to that."
"Yeah." China didn't know what to do with his empty can.
"Yeah, bullshit to that."
He reached down to the sea bag and unclipped the shoulder strap that also secured its opening.
"But I got something here, ain't no bullshit."
He pulled out the barrel of an M60 machine gun. Then he pulled out the back end, assembled it quickly, and handed it to the brother next to him. Then he pulled out an AK-47 and did the same thing. Then he pulled out a .45 pistol and handed it to Henry. Then he pulled out a second AK. He smiled.
"For the brothers back home."
Henry pulled back the receiver on the .45 and looked through the barrel. His two friends were similarly fiddling with the AK-47s, which were rare in rear areas. Henry smiled almost sadly.
"Where you get this shit, China?" he asked.
"We hit a big ammo dump. Me and some of the brothers been humping them in pieces ever since. I got the M-60 parts just saying mine wore out a little bit at a time, you know. And the 45, that's a combat loss. It was mine. I got me a new one."
Henry gave a sort of humph. China looked at him.
"What you mean, humph?"
Henry threw the 45 onto the end of his rack.
"You think the brothers back home can't get their own firearms? Shit, man. All they need is money, and they get all the fucking firepower they want. Don't you remember you lived in fucking America, China? We got more guns in America than your mama got boyfriends she don't know their names."
China struggled to master his temper. The reference to his mother was a typical Dozens insult. He wasn't about to let Henry know how close it had come to the truth.
"Have a bit help, Henry."
"Shit."
Henry stood up and walked over to a heavy, ornately carved Macassar ebony dresser he'd purchased in an illicit run to Cam Low, a matching piece for an equally heavy and ornate trunk with which he'd replaced his standard-issue footlocker.
"Besides, we don't get back to the real world soon. Those brothers back home have no fucking idea what to do with all that firepower. Shit, China. They'd be killing each other over who get to be professor of black studies at UCLA. Shit. Killing each other over who gonna be teacher to rich white girls and little China boys."
He spun a combination padlock that secured a beautiful silver hasp to one of the drawers.
"That killing be done by FBI undercover agents," China said. "Shit, China, get real, huh? That be nothing but Slauson's killing avenues."
Henry pulled the drawer completely out, put it on the steel runway matting that served as the tent's floor, and started taking out clothes and other articles. Then he carefully removed a false bottom and motioned China over to look at it. There were dozens of small plastic packages, some filled with marijuana, some with blocks of hash, many with a slightly different, nearly white powder China thought might be heroin. Henry then carefully replaced the false bottom.
"What you think that is, China?"
China didn't say anything. Henry put the false bottom back and pointed a long, graceful finger at it.
"That be green, pal. I could turn that into so much fucking artillery we can start our own fucking war."
He started putting the clothes and other articles back in.
"You go trade them AKs to some rear area cracker in Da Nang for some of that soda pop you like so much. Shit, China."
Henry's friends broke into chuckles. One of them reached into a side pocket in his trousers and pulled up a wad of military payment currency, waved it just slightly while smiling at China, and then stuffed it back into the pocket. China felt betrayed and foolish. He saw the amused eyes of Henry's friends looking at him. Henry had his head cocked slightly sideways and upward looking at him. China held his gaze.
"That shit be bad for the brothers, Henry. Malcolm X say to lay off that shit. The Panthers say to lay off that shit. Who says I be selling this shit to the brothers?"
"You don't tell me you're just selling it to Chucks?"
"Nah, maybe I ain't. So what?"
"That shit be bad.
So we fuck up some white boys with it. People buy this shit be nothing but dumb fucking animals anyway."
"That's what the mob say about selling shit to the black man."
"So now we getting even."
China set his lips tight.
"You giving all the money to the brothers back home?"
"What you think?"
Henry's tone was edgy. China didn't answer. If Henry was, he'd say yes. And if he wasn't, he'd still say yes. China knew when to drop something that needed dropping. He looked down at the weapons, wondering what to do with them. Henry stepped in and rescued him.
"Hey, man, it cool. It all cool. You just leave that shit with us, and next time one of the brothers get back to Da Nang, we trade it for some good stuff with the Navy and Air Force boys, and keep what we get for you next time you're out of the bush. You done good, brother. You trying."
Henry's patronizing tone increased the humiliation. China put on a cool exterior.
"Yeah. Okay.
I gotta get back before I get missed too much.
He turned to Henry's friends and went through the hand dance.
You brothers stay cool, okay?
Yeah, we be cool, you too, man.
China slipped out of the tent into the warm dark. He knew that in many ways he had experienced a serious defeat, and not just his own.
You alive for Lieutenant Fracasso?
Jankowicz asked blearily. It was now well past midnight, and the drinking had been going on for hours. Fracasso seemed uncomfortable. Getting drunk with the men the first night wasn't how he had expected to take over command as a new lieutenant.
What do you think, Corporal Jankowicz?
He replied.
Shit, Lieutenant, I don't know. Call me Jank.
Jankowicz paused a little, and Mellis could almost see the thoughts muddling around in his head the way he was muddling the beer around in the can.
I really like the Marine Corps, Fracasso answered carefully. Right now I think I'll be staying in.
God damn, sir, Bass hooted. It's about fucking time we got a lieutenant with some sense.
Bass hiccuped at just the right moment to make them all laugh.
Some lifers are okay,
Jankowicz said with finality,
and some ain't.
There it is, said Fredrickson. I'll drink to that.
Fucking air right you will, you squid asshole,
Jankowicz returned.
I said I would and I will, you jarhead asshole.
And I said that's fucking air right. Oh, you're a good fucking squid.
Jankowicz turned, smiled at everyone, and fell over backward, out cold.
You see, sir,
Bass said,
no fucking staying power like us lifers.
I guess not, Sergeant Bass,
Fracasso said. He smiled awkwardly. They sat in beery silence for a moment. Then the silence was broken by an animal-like scream.
Fucking white-ass knuckle bastard! I'll kill him! I'll kill him!
One of the groups in front of the large tent erupted in violent movement. Fracasso was instantly running to the fight. Mellis was so sick and weary he barely could get to his feet, but he lurched after Fracasso. When Mellis got there, a new guy was lying flat on his back, his face bleeding badly. Mellis saw the broken stubs of his two front teeth. Standing over him and breathing very hard was China. He had an E-tool in his hand.
Don't you get enough fucking fighting, China?
Jacobs screamed. He came hurtling across the small circle at China, and they both went down to the ground.
He got a knife, brother! He got a fucking knife!
Mellis broke through the crowd and jumped on Jacobs as hard as he could. He saw Cortell, his high forehead glistening, come in for China and tackle him. Without any sign, both Marines stopped struggling.
Anybody bleeding? Mellis was breathing hard.
Ah, shit, sir,
Jacobs said.
Ain't you got a fucking knife?
He opened his hand, pinned to his side by Mellis. It showed a muddy harmonica. Several people laughed.
First time I ever heard of assault with a deadly mouth harp, Mellis said.
You so okay now?
Yeah,
China muttered.
He didn't have to hit him with the fucking E-tool,
Jacobs said.
Fucking CID,
said China. He meant the Criminal Investigation Division.
Fucking cunt don't deserve to be alive.
Mellis stood and helped Jacobs to his feet.
How do you know he was from CID?
Mellis asked China, ignoring the moans of the man on the ground. Cortell still had his hands on China's arm.
He's a knock. You can smell the fuckers.
He asked you for some dope or something? Mellis asked.
Yeah, he asked me for dope.
Maybe he just wanted some. Did you ever think of that?
Why he asked me, huh? Why he asked me? A fucking chuck ass gonna split for dope? Shit, man, I don't even do that shit.
Mellis looked at the figure on the ground and bent down toward him. Fredrickson was already pushing in with his kit to start patching the guy up. If he went to the battalion aid station, there'd be shit to pay, and the company would lose both China and Jacobs. They were both too good to let go.
Hey, Fredrickson said to the man on the ground. What's your name, huh? You hear me?
The man groaned a name.
You in Bravo Company?
Mellis asked. The man nodded.
Were you asking about dope?
The man shook his head.
He's fucking lying, Lieutenant,
China cried. The man gave a hoarse scream and went for China, but both Fredrickson and Mellis held him down. China had the E-tool position for a perfect butt stroke, sharp end toward the man. It probably would have killed him.
You're a fucking fool, Mellis said quietly to the man on the ground.
He heard Bass clearing the Marines out, sending them away from the fight. He turned to Jacobs and China.
I'll see you two tomorrow about this. Now go sleep it off.
Fracasso was standing there with his mouth wide open.
Hey, Fracasso, don't worry about it, Mellis said. They're just letting off steam.
He looked at the man on the ground. He had no idea whether he was CID or not, but one thing was certain. He couldn't stay in the company.
Hey, look, whatever your name is, I'm going to transfer you out of the company. We can get it done, don't worry. You just keep quiet and this fight will never get on your record, all right?
I don't make deals,
the man said, spitting out blood. Bass shouted,
What?
He jumped on top of him.
You don't say fucking things like that to the lieutenant, you understand?
He started beating the man's head against the ground, rattling his body with his short, solid forearms.
You fucking understand?
The man couldn't answer because his head was being pounded into the ground. Finally, Bass stopped and started talking very quietly and very quickly, straddling his chest.
The lieutenant here just offered you two things. Your next promotion, if you want one, and your fucking life, because believe me, you fucking sneaky CID asshole, you'd last about one fucking hour on an operation if you don't make a deal.
Okay,
the man croaked. They took him to the supply tent, where Fitch was wearily catching up on paperwork by the light of a single candle. Fitch sent him back to the rear with a letter to Top Seavers the next morning, and that was the last they ever heard of him. Bass punished both Jacobs and China by taking them out of their place in line for KP duty. The next day the company moved to a cluster of drooping tents that bordered a secondary landing strip. On the other side of the strip, a stream meandered through a broad valley. Vandegrift Combat Base sat in the middle of that valley, between jungled ridges to its east and west. Across the stream on a small hill stood the bunkers and radio antennae of Task Force Oscar. No one in the company knew what Task Force Oscar did. The Marines could hear the sound of the generator that ran the air conditioning and electric lights. Occasionally an Army helicopter would arrive and a high-ranking Army officer would be met by someone in a jeep to be carried 200 meters to the air-conditioned bunker or the small officers' club next to it. Civilians, looking overweight and out of place in Army fatigues without any insignia, came as well. They were probably from AID and the CIA or journalists afraid to go out in the bush. Upstream from Task Force Oscar was a contingent of South Vietnamese troops who apparently also did nothing. The Marines watched them with unconcealed hostility, hating them for sitting around while others died fighting their battles, hating them because their very existence served as part of the lie that had brought American troops to Vietnam in the first place. It was easier to hate a visible part of the lie than it was to hate the liars, who, after all, were their own countrymen, the fat American civilians and rear-area rangers who flitted back and forth with briefcases, sweaty faces, and shiny unused pistols. But the Marines hated them, too. Some Marines hated the North Vietnamese Army, and some didn't, but at least the NVA had the Marines' respect. Caught up in the work of getting the tents into shape and cleaning out trenches, the Marines of the company could forget momentarily that they were waiting to be dropped into combat. But whenever a jeep came around the curve of the road a little faster than normal, or a helicopter rushed over their heads, fear and apprehension would return. Mellis took the opportunity provided by his new position to ask if he could accompany Fitch to the next battalion briefing. Fitch agreed. The next morning, the two of them entered the large tent that also served as a chapel and sat down on folding chairs. Hawk joined them. He had shaved off his mustache, and the sight almost made Mellis wince. It was a clear sign that Hawk was knuckling under to the rear area chicken shit. Hawk was also wearing shiny new boots. Mellis whistled and pointed at them. Hawk flipped him the bird. Major Blakely entered the tent and called everyone to attention. The colonel followed, striding briskly, nodding to Blakely to begin the meeting. Everyone sat down. Mellis looked sideways at Hawk, conveying the disgust he felt at the formal structure of rank and privilege. Hawk chose not to notice. Blakely stood with his back to the rough wooden altar and announced the disposition of the companies. Then the staff NCOs began to read out their reports. Some of them seemed nearly illiterate, but others were highly efficient and professional, making suggestions that Mellis could see were crucial to the operation of the battalion rear. Father Riordan, the Navy chaplain, got up and announced the coming services for the various faiths, trying to be one of the boys. At his appointed time, Sergeant Major Knapp rose, his slightly rounded body encased in starched jungle utilities, and began his part of the briefing.
"Gentlemen, staff NCOs," he said, "with the entire battalion moving in, the battalion commander feels, and I agree, that we have to be extra careful about our standards of appearance. I expect the staff NCOs to have every man looking like AJ squared away. We've particularly noticed the proliferation of beads, emblems, hangman's nooses, and mustaches."
Knapp looked directly at Fitch and Mellis.
"Mustaches are a privilege for E5s or higher. They are to be closely clipped and not extended beyond the outer edge of the upper lip. Now, I know we don't have as many E5s as we do mustaches,"
he chuckled good-humoredly,
"so let's get that kind of crap cleaned up. I'll be talking directly to all the staff NCOs as the companies come in."
Knapp smiled, turned to Blakely, and smiled again.
"That's all I have today, sir."
"Thank you, Sergeant Major," Blakely said. Blakely turned to Simpson. "It's yours, sir."
Simpson nodded and walked up to the pulpit to address his command. His sleeves were rolled neatly, and his silver leaves shone on his collar next to the wrinkled red skin of his neck. He reminded Mellis of an irritable gnome. A redneck gnome with a redneck Georgia accent, trying to act like gentry.
"Gentlemen, staff NCOs," he began. "First Battalion's going to get a goddamn chance to breathe. Then we'll be pushing off on the next operation. I can't tell you what that operation will be, but rest assured we'll be out in the bush either as individual companies, performing our constant task of hitting the enemy, interdicting his supply routes, uncovering his hospitals and ammunition caches, or..."
He paused significantly.
"We shall be working as we should. One entire massed battalion kicking the hell out of Charlie in a major strike against his north-south supply lines."
He paused to look at his men. Mellis was slumped in his chair, picking at some jungle rot on his hand. Fitch was writing something in his notebook. Hawk stared vacantly ahead.
"Gentlemen," Simpson continued, "we are under the happy circumstances that by tomorrow evening the entire battalion, less one platoon guarding the Cape Gear Bridge, should be here in Vandegrift Combat Base. I have decided it is a splendid opportunity to hold a formal mess night, a gathering of the officers of the battalion and an evening of fellowship and camaraderie. The mess night will go at 1800 hours, with cocktails in my quarters, to adjourn to the officers' mess at 1900 for a meal that I am sure Master Sergeant Hansen will have prepared to be fit for a king. I expect everyone to look their best."
There was silence in the tent. People smiled nervously. The staff sergeants, who weren't invited, looked the most uncomfortable. Mellis turned to look at Hawk and conspicuously opened his mouth to mime shocked surprise. Hawk ignored him. Major Blakely stood up. "I'm sure the officers who will be coming in from the bush, and of course all of us here, are going to be looking forward to Thursday night. I don't know if the younger officers are aware of it or not, but the tradition of mess night is one that goes back in time to our predecessors, the Royal Marines. To get a chance to do it while experiencing the intensity of combat is something that none of us will ever forget."
"He can say that again," Mellis whispered, looking straight ahead.
He expected some reply from Hawk, but got none. Hawk had taken out his notebook and was writing in it, an intent expression on his face. After the meeting broke up, Mellis stopped Hawk just outside the tent.
"What the hell happened to your stash?"
It fell off. What the fuck you think happened to it?
You didn't have to shave your fucking sense of humor off with it.
Look, Mellis, the fucking three and the colonel are on a big thing about beads, mustaches, hippie hairdos, and the hangman nooses. So everyone in battalion had to shave. I'm in the battalion, remember?
Mellis's anger at the colonel flashed to the surface.
What's the fucking point? It's one small thing these guys can do that gives them some kind of pride, and these rear area chicken shit fucks just take it away from them.
Look, smart guy,
Hawk said.
You push the colonel and the three too hard, and you're going to get into trouble. They're already just about as pissed as they can get.
What they got to be pissed about?
Simpson went on record more than once about Bravo Company's objectives. He had to eat crow every time in front of half the officers in the regiment because of Bravo Company.
He's the one that laid on the asinine fucking demands.
That's beside the point, and you're smart enough to know it. The point is the colonel's been passed over for bird colonel once already. This battalion is his last fucking chance. If he doesn't make it, it'll be Bravo Company's fault. The three is just a younger, smarter version of Simpson, and he isn't above making a few sacrifices to further his career either. And I don't mean personal sacrifices.
So they're all playing politics. Nothing new to me.
No, by God, I'll bet it isn't.
The two of them stood there facing off.
I'm trying to tell you don't fuck around with the guy,
Hawk said.
First Battalion isn't high on Mulvaney's list right now, and Simpson thinks Bravo Company's the reason. You guys are going to make or break his career as far as he's concerned.
Fuck him. I'd do anything in my power to keep that cocksucker from getting promoted.
Mellis started to walk away. Hawk grabbed him by the shoulder and spun him around.
You listen to me, you hot-shot Ivy League piece of shit. I don't give a goddamn what you do to yourself, but you're not going to fuck up the kids in this company. Those are my fucking guys, and I'll be goddamned if you or anyone else is going to fuck them up because of some personal vendetta. I don't give a shit how justified you think it is. I've worked a fuckload more shitty operations under that guy than you have.
Hawk was breathing hard.
You just get one thing straight, Mr. Politician. The colonel controls the helicopters.
Hawk released Mellis's shirt. His hands were shaking. Mellis backed away, frightened. They stood there looking at each other, breathing hard. Mellis realized how close they'd come to a real fight, how he'd developed a hair-trigger temper. He could see that Hawk felt bad, too. Mellis wanted to reach out and touch him, say he'd been an ass. He couldn't bear the thought of Hawk not being his friend anymore. The reference to his education and aspirations was especially hurtful. I'll talk to Jim, Mellis said. We'll clean up. I didn't mean to be an asshole about it. Hawk was looking at the hills, not at Mellis. He fumbled in his shirt pocket. I can't find a cigar, he said. It's good you can't find it, Mellis said. You want to get your ass out of here and die of cancer a few years later?
You believe that bullshit?
Hawk asked.
Uh-huh.
They looked at each other, both aware they were talking about death. Then Hawk spoke quietly.
I'm an asshole myself sometimes. The colonel's not the only one who's ambitious. Sure, I wanted Bravo Company when Jim got it. I had more time in the bush, and Jim made mistakes I'd already made and paid for, and I had to watch it happen all over again.
His eyes went blank. Mellis sensed that he was replaying some terrible scene. Hawk snapped back.
I don't want it to happen again. You know what that means? What I have to do to play the game?
Mellis nodded. Ted, I don't want the company. I just want out of the bush.
Let's at least not lie to each other, Hawk said.
Okay, Mellis said softly. I want it too. Then he quickly added, but I'd gladly hump under you, Hawk, really. I don't want it that bad.
I didn't think I did either.
There was an uncomfortable silence. I gotta get back, Mellis said finally.
Sure.
Mellis walked away, dejected. He wanted Hawk's friendship in the worst way.
Hey, Mel,
Hawk called. Mellis, his hands in his back pockets, turned to face Hawk.
McCarthy and Murphy are both going to be in from the bush. You know the platoon commander who had the dead guy when we flip-flopped with Alpha and Charlie?
Yeah.
That's McCarthy. Murphy's the big guy who was on the LZ.
Mellis looked a little puzzled.
With the tick.
Mellis nodded.
That's the mystery tour team. You want to come along? I'll sponsor you.
Sure, Mellis said.
But what the hell's a mystery tour?
It's a fucking drunk, Mellis. Mellis smiled sheepishly.
What time?
When Mellis reached the company, he was greeted with more than a few sarcastic jeers.
Lieutenant, you gonna send home for your dress blues for tomorrow night? You officers getting your nails buffed so you don't fuck up the silverware.
They're gonna start issuing tablecloths with the sea rats, Lieutenant.
Mellis had to take the ribbing, and he knew it. Mess night was a dumb fucking idea. He went over to his rubber lady and lay down with a dog-eared copy of James Michener's The Source, for which he'd traded two Louis L'Amour shit-kickers. He tried to lose himself in ancient Israel. He was interrupted by China.
Hey, sir, can we talk to you?
A tall black Marine stood behind China at the opening of the tent. Mellis motioned them in.
What's on your mind?
He asked.
Sir, China said, pointing to his friend. This is Lance Corporal Walker. We call him Henry. He's from H&S Company.
Hello, Walker.
Mellis held out his hand and they shook.
We got ourselves a little sort of club, China went on. We get together every once in a while, play some sounds, you know.
Sounds nice, Mellis said, trying to be casual.
He was beginning to feel uneasy, particularly with Walker, who scared him. He decided to be direct.
Cassidy said you had some sort of black power group you were involved in. Is that what he means?
They both laughed.
Cassidy! China spat the name out. That fucking redneck cracker don't know shit from Shinola. Black power. Shit! That's a word for a political movement, and that's what it mean. Cassidy just a fucking bigot.
There was silence. Mellis wondered if he should tell them he used to be a member of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which organized students to go to the South for voter registration when he was a freshman at Princeton. That was before Stokely Carmichael threw the whites out and Mellis found other things to do with his time, like driving to Bryn Mawr. China broke the silence.
We just got this club is all. It ain't no fucking black power harem scarem. We got enough fucking violence around here. Besides, black power ain't about violence. It'd be about black people getting political and economic power. It'd be about self-image and leadership and getting the law to treat us the same as whites. That sounds scary to you, sir?
Sounds like a good enough thing to me, Mellis said.
He wished China would come to the point, but was afraid to push him.
Yeah, sir. It is a good thing. See, Henry here and me, we sort of run the meetings and make the policy, you know?
China's husky voice seemed to hide his inner detachment. Mellis could see a twinkle of merriment in his eyes, as if there were another China sitting back from the conversation, watching the three of them and laughing his ass off.
Well, sir, China added, we want to try and smooth out some of the differences between blacks and whites right here in our own area. You see, sir, we get a lot of literature from the brothers back home, and a lot of the stuff is hard stuff, man, hard stuff. I mean, they are advocating violence.
I know, Mellis said. I've seen some of it.
Well, sir, Henry said, some of the brothers, they've had it right up to where they can't take no more. You know what I mean? Right up to their fucking throats.
Henry's anger began to show slightly.
So Walker and I was talking last night, China broke in, that maybe we ought to do something about it so as we'd keep some of the brothers.
He paused.
Well, so we could stop something like fragging from happening.
Mellis's eyes darted from one face to the other, looking for a clue to help him. It had never happened to him before, but he knew the protection racket when he saw it. He decided to play dumb. You think someone's going to get fragged?
Us? Henry said. Nah, not us. But then again, that might happen. You take a guy like Parker, you know.
The one they humped to death and wouldn't medevac. You remember him, Lieutenant?
Mellis swallowed, wishing someone would return from Chow to break up the situation. Parker's death was an accident. No one knew what he had. We tried to get him out as soon as we could.
As soon as a white boy got sick, China said, and white boy, he gets out.
I don't want to hear any more about it, China, Mellis said. Challen barely lived himself, and it had nothing to do with his color. I don't want to hear anything more about it. I had to watch Parker die.
What China means, sir, Walker said, is we're on the edge of things around here, and lots of these guys maybe ain't so smart, and if they get fucked with enough, they're liable to do something that gets themselves into trouble.
China said,
I mean, if it's okay to grease a fucking gook that don't fuck with you at all, then why not waste some fucking bigot that be fucking with you every day of your life? That's fucking common sense.
That's murder, Mella said.
Murder, China said. Shit, we all a bunch of murderers. What difference it make if you kill a yellow man or a white bigot? You explain it to me, Lieutenant. You went to college.
I don't see what all this has to do with me, Mellis said.
We want to smooth things out before they get too tough, Henry said with an easy smile. Maybe we can stop something from happening.
Go on, Mellis said.
China here was telling me that some of the brothers have a thing out for Cassidy. Maybe some of them might lose their tempers and do something that'd get them in trouble. We want to avoid trouble, is all.
Mellis glanced quickly at the tent opening and waited for Henry to continue. Neither Henry nor China said any more.
Well, that's part of my job, Mellis finally said. Avoiding trouble. How can I help out?
Nothing special, China said. Maybe just talk to Cassidy and tell him to ease up on harassing the brothers, and maybe you ask him to apologize.
Apologize? Mellis snorted in disgust. What the fuck chance do you think I have of getting Cassidy to apologize? And for what?
Trying knocking a man's teeth in with a machine gun barrel, China said.
Henry added,
and maybe you slipped someone the word about none of the brothers having to serve you dinner like fucking slaves tomorrow night.
Look, Walker, I have nothing to do with that. I disagree with it, and I don't intend to go.
You the one wanted to know how to help out, avoiding trouble. Shit.
Walker, I don't have to take crap like that from you.
That's right. You an officer and I a fucking snuff nigger.
I didn't mean it that way.
Shit. Henry turned to China. But shit you feeding me. He ain't no different than the rest of them.
Mellis's ears were burning. He looked at China.
Reason we come to you, Lieutenant Mellis, China said, was because we figured you'd be the only one we could talk to.
I appreciate that, China, Mellis said. I'll try to help. Just don't push me.
We ain't pushing nobody, China said. We're just trying to explain the situation is all.
China looked over at Henry, then back at Mellis.
We're on the edge, sir, he added.
I'll see what I can do, Mellis said.
The two of them left. Mellis picked up his book but found it difficult to read. He stared at the cover, his body buzzing with the electricity of the encounter and the talk of trouble. But at the same time, he was also slightly pleased. The brothers had come to him. After Chow, Mellis wandered over to the sagging tent behind the Combat Operations Center. It was already dark, and a soft drizzle was falling. He felt oddly content. Perhaps it was the beef hash he'd eaten and the steaming coffee he'd chased it down with. He tripped across several blown stumps and a couple of guy ropes before he stumbled into the tent. Hawk was alone, sitting on a cot and shining his new boots by the light of a candle. Only three of the six cots had mattresses. Hawk's old bleach boots were neatly placed beneath his cot. "What you polishing your boots for?" Mellis asked. "You just got 'em." "I'm getting a medal," Hawk said without looking up. "Hey, no shit. Fan-fucking-tastic. What are you getting?" "Bronze star." "Out-fucking-standing, Jayhawk!" Mellis gave the Hawk power sign and grinned. The thought of Hawk getting a medal filled him with pride. "Yeah,"
Hawk said, trying to repress a smile. I'm sort of proud of it.
What'd you do?
Mellis asked.
Oh, that fucking thing where I ran around in the open and called some oddie in on some gook oddie from Co-Rock that was beating the shit out of us at Langvay.
I'd heard about that, actually, Mellis said.
Really? First day I got assigned to Bravo Company back in Quang Tri, the clerks were talking about it.
No shit. Hawk let himself smile.
You know, Mel, I used to think a medal was a bunch of bullshit and I'd never really care. I was wrong. You get caught up in the little values of where you're at, I guess. So I'm proud of it. And I'm embarrassed about it. I know a lot of guys have done what I did and gotten nothing, usually snuffs.
Then there's the field grade officer who ran a mediocre supply dump in Da Nang and got the same thing.
He started polishing a boot furiously. He finally put the shined boot down and reached under the cot for his old jungle boots. He put them on, smiling grimly, then put his hands on his knees and looked at Mellis.
I'm tired of waiting for those two Irish assholes. I got 6 six-packs and a bottle of Jack Black. Let's get fucked up.
Okay by me, Mellis said.
Mystery tour!
Hawk shouted at the top of his lungs and did the Hawk dance.
Mystery tour!
He pulled the bottle of bourbon from his pack and poured Mellis and himself drinks in 2 heavy white coffee mugs. He raised his mug to Mellis's, and at that moment the flap of the tent parted and the door was filled by the huge bulk of Jack Murphy. Mellis had last seen Murphy in exhausted sleep on the LZ that Bravo had flown to from Matterhorn. Behind him was McCarthy. Mellis tried to push away the image of McCarthy, shaking and asking for a cigarette, his men stumbling to join him with the body swaying between them. Then he saw Williams, then Parker.
Hey, hey, hey!
McCarthy pushed ahead of Murphy, and he and Hawk started doing a noisy jig.
You both met Mellis?
Hawk said, stopping to pour whiskey into 2 more mugs. McCarthy produced a 5th of vodka. Murphy had a 1/2 pint of scotch and several small cans of sardines packed in olive oil, as well as a box of Ritz crackers. An hour later, they were giggling helplessly as Mellis stabbed at one of the sardine cans with Hawk's K-bar. Finally, in a rage, he started stabbing it randomly, squirting olive oil on his face and forehead.
Fuck, Mellis, give up!
McCarthy said, laughing. After some more furious stabbing, Mellis grabbed the oily can and smashed it against his forehead. He sighed as the oil ran off his chin. He sat down on the tent floor, his back against Hawk's rack, and shut his eyes.
God damn it, Mellis!
Hawk shouted at him.
You can't go to sleep now, we're just fucking starting!
He began to slap Mellis lightly on the cheek. Mellis opened his eyes and grinned slowly. Hawk poured beer over Mellis's head.
We've still got 36 beers to get through.
Fuck you, Hawk. I was just resting my eyes. He looked up at the 3 friends. He knew he'd been let into the group. Wonderfully, mindlessly drunk 2 hours later, the 4 lieutenants were sneaking in brief rushes up to the regimental motor pool, suppressing laughter. Hawk was leading them with hand signals learned at the basic school, doing everything exactly to form. Their target was a 1/2-ton truck.
Keep your fucking ass down, Murphy,
Hawk whispered. Murphy giggled like a child.
Fire team in the assault. Ready!
Hawk raised his arm.
Ho!
He pointed at the truck, and the 4 of them rushed it. Mellis and Murphy piled into the back while Hawk and McCarthy scrambled into the cab and kicked over the engine. They roared off down the road toward the regimental officers' club. 1/2 hour later, the movie at the small officers' club was interrupted by a wildly gesturing figure who tried to embrace the woman on the screen. The screen came down with a crash. Trying to make his escape in the dark, Murphy tripped over a power cord and pulled the projector off the table. Hawk shouted,
"Retreat! Retreat! Abandon ship!"
The mystery tour bolted for the door they'd staggered through 20 minutes earlier. Murphy panicked, still tangled in the electric cord. In the darkness and confusion, he missed the door by 2 feet and took out approximately 12 square feet of fine wire insect screen.
As the four lieutenants piled into the truck, several officers shouted behind them, equally drunk. One of them pulled a pistol out and fired it into the air. He and two other dark figures jumped into a jeep and took off in pursuit. The man with the pistol was waving it over his head, laughing and shouting, "Saboteurs! Saboteurs! Rape and pillage in the village!" He was about to fire two more rounds into the air just as the jeep bounced over a rut and the driver swerved violently to the side. The force of the turn and gravity pulled the heavy .45 down as it went off. McCarthy, in the bed of the truck with Mellis, groaned and slumped to the floor. Mellis immediately got sober and very frightened. He knew they were in big trouble. He kicked in the rear window of the truck's cab and screamed at Hawk, who was driving.
"McCarthy's fucking hit! We gotta get him out of here!"
Hawk turned to look at Mellis. The whites of his eyes were prominent. He then looked back to the road.
"McCarthy's fucking shot, I tell you!"
Hawk turned the truck off the road, bouncing up a hill through low shrubs. It smashed against a blown stump, sending Murphy forward against the windshield and slamming Mellis up against the back of the cab. McCarthy came sliding forward, crumpling against Mellis. They piled out and dragged McCarthy into the bushes, struggling uphill. The jeep roared past them down the road.
"Why are you guys carrying me?"
McCarthy asked suddenly.
"You ain't fucking shot?"
Hawk asked.
"That fucker shot the half pint I was saving for the re-entry. I got glass in my fucking ass."
They threw him to the ground, disgusted. McCarthy giggled and pushed himself uncertainly to his feet. The four of them walked through the bushes, eventually coming to a cleared piece of ground. A frightened voice shouted a challenge. They hit the deck immediately.
"Don't shoot," Hawk called. "You'll be doing our country and the Corps a great disservice." "I'm my motherfucker,"
the voice shouted back.
"Only I won't do my Corps fucking nothing. I'm in the army. Come any closer and I'll blow your ass away."
"Where in hell are we?"
Mellis hollered.
"You think I tell you, you gook bastard?"
"Me a gook bastard?" Mellis said to the others quietly. They were all giggling.
"Hey, Melican soldier,"
Hawk called out.
"Me educated UCRA. You no shoot friendly countryman. That number 10. You number 1.
"You really Americans?"
"What the fuck do you think, asshole?"
Hawk shouted sharply.
"Is the Pope Catholic? The dogs lick their own balls?"
A pop-up flare shot out, casting eerie flickering green shadows over the landscape. The four lieutenants hugged the ground. Mellis caught a glimpse of the long barrels of an Army 175 battery that obviously ran its own security inside VCB's main defensive lines.
"Prove you're Americans,"
the voice called out.
"How the fuck we do that?"
Hawk called back.
"Answer my questions." "Okay, but don't ask me nothing about fucking baseball. I hate fucking baseball." "All right, where are you guys from?"
McCarthy giggled.
"Let me,"
he whispered.
"East Padua,"
he cried out.
"You know where that is?" "East Padua? No,"
Hawk cut in.
"Hey, asshole, you're supposed to be asking the questions."
There was silence.
"All right, who's the Secretary of the Army?"
"I don't know,"
McCarthy replied.
"Okay, then who's the Secretary of Defense?"
Murphy answered.
"Who the fuck cares?"
"I do,"
the voice answered.
"I don't know,"
McCarthy said.
"Who's the president, then?"
"You got me beat,"
McCarthy answered.
"I'm a gook."
"You must be fucking Marines. No one else could be so fucking stupid. Get your asses in here."
An hour later, the mystery tour was at rest. McCarthy and Murphy were passed out on the exposed springs of two empty cots. McCarthy was naked from the waist down, and his right buttock and thigh were swabbed red with mercurochrome. The bullet had taken out a small piece of flesh from the right cheek. Pieces of glass lay on the floor. Murphy had performed surgery by pouring vodka on McCarthy's rear and picking the glass out with his K-bar. Mellis was heating coffee over a piece of C4. He had thrown up, and his face was pallid.
The coffee was for Hawk, who needed to sober up enough to stand watch in an hour. Melis's first mystery tour was over. It felt very good to be in. Chapter 12. Morning started with the barking cough of a motor and the clank of treads as a tank headed for VCB's northern gate to escort the empty supply trucks returning to Quang Tri. Soon the grumble of truck motors vibrated through the ground to the wooden tent platform, rattling Melis's very sore head. Palak, who had the last radio watch, lit a ball of C4 to heat coffee. A white-hot glare filled the tent. Melis cursed Palak and pulled his poncho liner over his head. Fitch rolled onto his back and lay staring at the tent roof. The others, all completely clothed, including boots, moved stiff limbs and rolled from their air mattresses to the dirty wood floor. "Anything happen on the nets?" Fitch asked.
"Nah," Palak replied. "Same old stuff. Some super grunts got in a jam up north of Sky Cap."
Fitch glanced quickly at Daniels, who pulled out his map. Rescuing reconnaissance teams was a primary mission of a Bald Eagle Sparrowhawk company.
"Is that all you know about them?"
Fitch asked. Melis lay there listening, under the poncho liner.
"Shit, Skipper, they don't tell me what's happening all over I-Corps. Call signs Peach State. There's a bunch of gooks all around them, and they can't move without tipping the gooks off where they are. Here's the coordinates."
Fitch and Daniels checked the coordinates on the map. "Right where Melis guessed," Fitch said.
"Maybe they'll use Artie and yank them out, Skipper,"
Daniels said.
"Fuck,"
Palak said.
"Don't tell me they're expecting us to get their asses unjammed." "What the fuck you think we're sitting here for?"
Fitch said.
"The Artie's all been pulled back for the comm low-up. If they get in trouble, we launch." "Shit. If I'd have known, I'd gotten scared last night."
Melis moaned, threw back the poncho liner, and disappeared outside the tent.
"What's with him?" Fitch asked. "He's got Mallory's problem,"
Palak said.
"Huh?" "A bad head."
Fitch went to the COC to keep tabs on Peach State. Around mid-morning, the word came down to put the company on standby. Melis's bad head got worse. Everyone sat there, waiting, watching the sky, listening for the sound of choppers. All the spare radios were turned to the reconnaissance battalion's frequency so the company could listen to the team's progress. Cassidy passed out the hair clippers to the squad leaders. At 1300, Peach State made a break for it. At 1415, they were picked up by a Huey and got out with only one man wounded. By 1500, the Marines from Bravo Company were again filling sandbags at Task Force Oscar, rescuing knights one moment, serfs the next. Melis went to see Sergeant Major Knapp at the tent that served as the battalion office. He knocked sharply at the wood-framed opening and heard Knapp say,
"Come!"
It was more of a command than an invitation. Melis entered, taking off his cap. Knapp looked up from a report and quickly rose to his feet. That embarrassed Melis. The Sergeant Major was old enough to be his father.
"Yes, sir. Can I help you, sir?"
Knapp asked. "I hope so, Sergeant Major," Melis replied. "Can I sit down?"
"Of course."
They sat, and Melis toyed briefly with his cap, going over the words he'd already worked out. He waited for Knapp to say something first, to break the silence, in this way putting himself at a slight power advantage by establishing an unconscious obligation on Knapp's part to make the situation agreeable. Melis understood clearly that a second lieutenant nominally outranked but never outpowered a sergeant major. A sergeant major in the United States Marine Corps took shit from no one. This was going to be tricky. Melis could tell that Knapp was scrambling to remember which company he was from. Finally, Knapp said,
"I thought you folks were going to have to bail out that recon team. Close."
"Too close," Melis replied. "I'd almost rather get launched right off the bat instead of standing by on that airfield." Melis laughed casually. He'd have stayed on the airfield forever, and he knew it.
"I know what you mean, sir."
Again, Melis waited.
"So how can I help, sir?"
"Sergeant Major, it's about Staff Sergeant Cassidy, our company gunny."
I can't imagine he's giving you a problem.
Well, I don't know how to put this exactly, but I'm afraid for his life.
How so?
The sergeant major leaned back, squinting slightly at Mellis, obviously not liking where this might lead. Can we treat everything I say in complete confidence? Sergeant Major Knapp hesitated.
As long as it's not in violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, he said carefully.
Okay. Mellis paused for effect. On the last operation, an attempt was made on Staff Sergeant Cassidy's life. The person involved, PFC Parker, blurted it out the morning he died of cerebral malaria. Cassidy never said a word about it. I never asked him. There is, therefore, no charge. Since the party involved is dead, I see no reason to make an inquiry. Do you? The sergeant major hesitated.
That might be a violation of the code.
There would be no witnesses, no formal charge. It would only draw attention to racial unrest between one of your staff sergeants and a black PFC who died because a medevac bird was refused the day before by a battalion order. The sergeant major jerked his head backward almost imperceptibly.
Yes, I see what you mean.
Mellis continued. I have it from certain sources close to radical black elements that Staff Sergeant Cassidy is still in danger. Knapp took a deep breath through his nose, his lips compressed tightly. He exhaled.
Can I ask why, sir?
Staff Sergeant Cassidy isn't exactly tactful in the way he gets his job done, Mellis smiled, particularly with blacks. Knapp smiled back.
I know what you mean.
I think the best thing would be to transfer him out of the company, Mellis said. They're asking for certain changes and an apology from Cassidy. I don't think I need to tell you the chances of that happening.
He'd do it if he was ordered to.
Yes, Mellis said. And what would that mean for the authority of the rest of the staff NCOs?
Yes, I see.
Mellis let that sink in before going on. Cassidy doesn't need to know anything about the transfer. It would diffuse the situation. If we investigate, who knows where it will lead us?
And Lieutenant Fitch, what does he think of this?
You and I are the only ones who know. You can see what a bind that would put Fitch in, and the Colonel too, for that matter. The Colonel would be obligated to start a formal investigation.
Yes, I see, sir.
Knapp drummed his neatly trimmed nails on the plywood table. He rubbed the back of his neck.
I could use someone to handle work parties here in the rear. The lines will probably have to be expanded, bunkers built. There's a lot to running a place like this, you know?
I can sure see that, Sergeant Major. It's amazing how much has to get done and fuck all recognition for it. Mellis laughed lightly. I remember being a guard on my football team and reading in the papers that somehow it was the halfbacks who scored all the points, not the team. Knapp looked pleased by the remark.
Yes, sir. It ain't any different here either.
Mellis smiled.
Nope, no different, he said.
No matter where you go, it's still high school. The sergeant major laughed. Mellis repressed a smile at the irony of Knapp's laughing at a statement that actually was about him.
Okay, I'll see what I can do, sir,
Knapp said.
No promises, but we'd sure hate to have the death of a good Marine on our hands.
That's the way I feel, Sergeant Major. I knew you'd understand.
I appreciate your stopping by, Lieutenant.
He stood as Mellis did, and they shook hands. The Sergeant Major walked with Mellis to the door of the tent. There's one other thing, Sergeant Major, Mellis said.
Sir?
It might be a little awkward if any blacks had to wait on tables at mess night. The sergeant major's smile disappeared.
If they've drawn KP, they'll do what they're told. We don't play favorites here.
Of course not, Mellis said. And I admire that you would accept the responsibility for a fragging rather than compromise your principles. Any board of inquiry would approve. The sergeant major's breath was coming faster. He swallowed visibly.
I didn't mean I'd risk a fragging.
Of course you didn't, Mellis said. I know that, Sergeant Major. I know you don't like being put in this jam any more than I do. It's a tough place to be. I really do appreciate your help on this. Thank you, Sergeant Major. Mellis turned and went out of the tent. He carefully adjusted his stateside utility cover and headed back to the airstrip. He had no doubt about what the Sergeant Major would do. Several hours later, Mellis and the other officers were running through the rain to the large chapel tent. Hawk and McCarthy, the latter apparently none the worse for the glass in his rear end, were standing outside in the drizzle. Hawk shook his head silently. An enlisted man from McCarthy's platoon in Alpha Company, wearing a white coat dredged up from Da Nang, trudged past them carrying a large pot of soup. He managed to work enough of his right hand loose to give McCarthy the finger.
"Suck out, Wick,"
McCarthy hissed back at him. The kid disappeared inside. Candles lighted the interior, casting a flickering yellow glow over everything. Tables were arranged in a large U-shape and covered with white cloths. The battalion communications officer stuck his head out the door.
"You better get in and find your place cards. We're all supposed to be standing by when the colonel arrives. Blakely's orders."
He scurried back inside. Hawk sighed and walked in. The others followed. The tent's ventilation flaps had been closed because of the rain, and it was uncomfortably warm inside. Several enlisted men waited in the rear, standing by their pots of food, sweating beneath their starched white coats. Mellis noted that there were no blacks among them. Short Round, at the very end of the line next to a large pot of string beans, grinned broadly when he saw the lieutenants from Bravo Company under the tent. Mellis was happy to see him, but suppressed a grin and just nodded quickly. Hawk gave the Hawk power sign, and Short Round returned it, wiggling his fingers next to his hip, smiling proudly to be included in Hawk's private joke. Mellis found his place card opposite Hawk, and between Captain Coates, the skipper of Charlie Company, whom he'd last seen passed out on the wet LZ, and a new lieutenant from Alpha Company. The new lieutenant and Coates exchanged pleasantries with Mellis, to which he barely replied. This was Mellis's way of showing that he was here against his will and was not enjoying himself. The conversation lagged, and an awkward silence followed. The tension was released when the three walked in the tent, calling everyone to attention. Blakely's jungle utilities were starched stiff, and his major's leaves shone in the candlelight. He stood ramrod straight and cut an impressive figure. There was no doubt in Mellis's mind that the fucking prig would be a general one day. Simpson strode in, flushed with excitement and pride.
"Gentlemen, be seated,"
he said crisply. The benches rumbled on the plywood floor as about 30 officers sat down. Blakely gave a brief talk on the tradition of mess night and raised his glass in a toast, and the official drinking began. By the time they were through dessert, they had, for the most part, finished at least a bottle of wine each. Conversation had risen to a clamor punctuated by outbursts of laughter. No one noticed the colonel rise from his chair to give a toast except Major Blakely, who clinked his glass to get the tent quiet. Just like the fucking Rotary Club, Mellis thought darkly. All the voices died down except McCarthy's. He was well into his second bottle of wine and was telling a new second lieutenant his favorite story about the three.
"But we're fucking out here," the skipper says, "and I don't care what your goddamn map says, we're out here. And you're back there. And I tell you, we see fucking lights on Hill 967. But this fucking asshole tells us it's impossible and over the radio, for shit's sake, that we can't see what's in front of our fucking faces."
The new lieutenant was tugging at McCarthy's sleeve and urgently nodding toward the head table. McCarthy turned darkly and leaned back, folding his arms. The three announced that the colonel had something to say. His eyes never left McCarthy. Simpson, mildly and happily drunk, gave a quick official smile. He spilled a little of his wine as he leaned forward with his hands on both sides of his plate. Then he stood straight, bringing his glass up with him.
"Gentlemen, 1st Battalion, 24th Marines has made a fine name for itself here in Vietnam. I'm both humble and proud to address you, the officers who have contributed so greatly to that record."
He lowered his voice and looked down at his dessert plate, where the ice cream that had been flown in from Quang Tri that afternoon was melting.
And to remember those officers who contributed their most precious possession, sacrificing all they had that the record might remain proud and noble.
He means the ones that got wasted, Mellis whispered to the new lieutenant next to him without turning his head. Captain Coates touched Mellis's boot with his own.
We took command of this battalion at the commencement of Operation Cathedral Forest,
the colonel continued.
A drive deep into the DMZ that resulted in significant findings of material, significant contact, and significant kills. From Cathedral Forest to Wind River at the gateway to Laos. I'm sure many of you recall with fondness our friends from Coal Rock.
About half of the officers laughed. Hawk wasn't one of them.
Well, we got our own artillery, fire support base lookout, Puller, Sherpa, Margo, Sierra, Skycap.
The colonel paused.
And Matterhorn.
He looked at his silent officers.
We're building fountainheads of steel right in the gook's backyard. We're denying him the use of his own transportation network, forcing him to go further and farther west, making his resupply more and more difficult for his operations in the populated provinces to our south.
Simpson paused here and changed his tone.
We've been sitting on our asses around Comlo and, in my opinion, abandoned our mission.
He leaned across the table.
Well, gentlemen, we are through with the political bullshit. From now on, we'll be back at our real job, closing with and destroying the enemy, wherever he may be. And, gentlemen, I know where he is. I know.
He was leaning on his arms and looking intently at them, his eyes darting back and forth. Then he stood up for effect, head high, shoulders back. Mellis raised his eyebrows, looking at Hawk across from him.
He's around Matterhorn,
the colonel continued. His eyes glittered. He leaned forward again, his small red hands in fists on the table.
Yes, goddammit, Matterhorn! The gooks are there, hiding! And by God, we're going to walk in there someday and kill every one of the yellow sons of bitches! We were ordered off, Matterhorn, against my will, and against my own and my operations officer's best judgment, to fulfill the wishes of some fat-ass politicians back in Washington. But every sign...
He emphasized his words with his fist.
Every single piece of intelligence, every little contact.
He pushed back and smiled.
My fucking nose,
he touched it,
tells me that the NVA are in there and in force, and that area is ours, gentlemen. We paid for it in blood, and we'll get our due.
That's bullshit. Mellis whispered to the new lieutenant. There's nothing up there but leeches and malaria. Coates elbowed Mellis in the ribs and glared at him. Hawk was staring stonily at his fork.
We had to leave Matterhorn before our work there was finished,
Simpson continued.
And Marines never leave their work unfinished. I promise you this, gentlemen. I'll do every goddamn thing I can to get this battalion where it belongs. That's where the farting's going to be. That's where I want to be. That's where Major Blakely wants to be, and I know that's where every Marine in this battalion wants to be.
At this point, McCarthy quietly belched, out of earshot of the head table.
So, gentlemen,
the colonel went on,
I'd like to propose a toast to the best goddamn farting battalion in Vietnam today. Here's to the Tigers of Tarawa! The Frozen Chosen of Chosen Reservoir. Here's to the 1st Battalion, 24th Marines!
The officers stood, echoing the toast. Then they sat down with the colonel, who received congratulations on his fine toast from Blakely. Coates turned to Mellis, his eyes dancing with deep humor. Cool down, Lieutenant Mellis. Colonel Mulvaney will never let him near the place. You don't commit an entire battalion to an area covered by enemy artillery that we can't go after because of political reasons. Add to that uncertain air support because of the weather,
that